is knowing. Crow!
All right, Mal, welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is actually part two of the Robber Baron series. It's going to be episode number 632. We did part one. We asked folks if they wanted a part two. Here it is. Welcome, Jason.
And a hot Louisiana good morning.
I wish I could say that. I am in rain again, and it looks like I'm going to have to wait another week for a sunny day to bust out the old scope. It's starting to be a pattern here. But anything you want to offer up before we jump into the extensive notes?
So we're recording this the day after our live stream that we had on Friday, and I have to say that was quite a good success. Thank you for everyone for showing up.
It was a great live stream. So much participation, great people, made it totally worth doing. I always have some qualms, personal qualms about doing anything on YouTube because of how they've treated me in the past and what I know they do with content. But what happened last night made it all worth it. And a lot of people came over to the website, which is even better because that's where we do everything. We do not bend to censorship. We pay for our own private server. So everything is on crow777radio.com for membership. Anyhow, Jason, let's jump in to the Rise of the Robber Barons, part two, the so-called men who planted seeds that we are still contending with.
John Pierpont Morgan, who lived from 1837 to 1913 and was known as J.P. Morgan, was one of the most influential robber barons of the Gilded Age, dominating American finance and industry through his banking firm, J.P. Morgan & Company. He was born on April 17, 1837, in Hartford, Connecticut, to Junius Spencer Morgan, a wealthy banker, and Juliet Pierpont. The Morgan family's affluence and connections to London's banking elite would provide J.P. with a privileged upbringing. His early exposure to high finance through his father's firm, Peabody & Company, instilled an elitist worldview which would later be criticized as detached from ordinary Americans. J.P. attends the English High School in Boston, as well as studying in Switzerland and Germany, where he mastered French and German. He then enrolls at the University of Göttingen, excelling in mathematics. His European education, which was quite rare for Americans, reinforced perceptions of J.P. as an aristocratic financier, out of touch with Gilded Age workers, akin to Vanderbilt's aloofness.
We've covered education. Can you even start to imagine the education that this man was provided? And talk about living in a bubble. You know, back then, there is no instant information, anything. I would get the impression that he lived completely in the upper crust bubble and viewed everyone with disdain. But look at the name of his father. Can we deduce where those roots go? Junius, for crying out loud.
In 1857, at the age of 20, J.P. joins Duncan, Sherman & Company, a New York banking firm that is tied to his father's London business, where he begins to learn international finance, handling transatlantic transactions during the Panic of 1857. J.P.'s early dealings capitalize on the panic's chaos, buying distressed assets, a tactic that would later be refined in the 1873 panic, mirroring Vanderbilt's 1857 acquisitions. In 1860, he has his first speculative venture in which he engages in a controversial coffee speculation, buying a shipment and reselling it at a profit. The deal, though legal, raises ethical questions among peers for its opportunism. The coffee deal foreshadows J.P.'s willingness to exploit market volatility, a trait that critics later tied to his monopolistic consolidations, similar to Rockefeller's 1873 refinery buys. Moving to the Civil War era, J.P. also avoids military service by paying a $300 substitute, just like John D. He finances Union war efforts through bond sales, which earns commissions via his father's firm, now J.S. Morgan & Company in London. His firm profits from transatlantic gold trades, which is exploiting wartime currency fluctuations. In 1861, J.P. partially finances the Hall Carbine Affair, a scandal where defective rifles are sold to the Union Army at inflated prices. Though not said to be directly responsible, his involvement taints his reputation, drawing comparisons to Vanderbilt's faulty ship sales. In 1864, he establishes his own firm, Dabney, Morgan & Company, in New York, focusing on securities and foreign exchange, and begins building a reputation as a reliable banker. JP's early success relies on insider connections, including his father's London network, raising questions about favoritism, which is akin to Rockefeller's 1870s railroad rebates. At the age of 32 in 1869, JP battles Jay Gould and Jim Fisk for control of the Albany and Susquehanna Railroad, using stock purchases and legal maneuvers to secure it for his clients. His victory establishes him as a railroad financier, but his tactics, including stock manipulation and political lobbying, echo Daniel Drew's, Jim Fisk's, and Jay Gould's Erie War from 1866 to 1868 against Cornelius Vanderbilt, foreshadowing his own monopolistic railroad consolidations.
It starts to draw a picture, besides all the Roman surnames that get sprinkled through, kind of showing where this goes to. A lot of people say these guys are above the law. I'd say they're below the law. Most people in business ventures think, well, how can I avoid breaking the law so I don't get in trouble? These guys are below the law. They don't think that way at all. They think, how can I bend it, break it, get away with as much as I can, like monopoly or panic buying or things where normal people would consider other human beings. These guys are going the other way. And why? Because they're untouchable. They're in. They're what I call below the law. And they just throw all niceties out the window, and whatever they can get away with makes it okay. If you can succeed at a thing, doesn't matter how you got there.
You're also going to see that a lot of these guys, now that we're on to the third one, they're using the same tactics, and they're exploiting what loopholes they could find in the banking systems at the time.
Absolutely. And when you look at the panic buying, what do you think the average person's dealing with? Well, there's something going on that's bad here. We're being infected away. But again, these guys are above it or below it, whatever you want to call it. They don't think of that at all. And by the way, if you have a situation that gets out of hand and then they go in and make a lot of money on it, is this the roots of, hey, we'll cause the problem now so that we can make money on it?
Are you implying that these people lacked morals and ethics?
I'm implying that how they treat other human beings almost makes them another species. Yes.
In 1871, at the age of 34, J.P. Morgan and Anthony J. Drexel merge their operations to form Drexel, Morgan & Company, which is headquartered at 23 Wall Street in New York City. The partnership combines Morgan's New York firm, Dabney, Morgan & Company, with Drexel's Philadelphia-based Drexel & Company, creating a transatlantic banking powerhouse. As the junior partner at 34, JP led New York operations, leveraging his energy, mathematical skill, and connections to his father's London firm, J.S. Morgan & Company, focusing on deal-making, client relations, and strategic vision. At 45, Anthony J. Drexel provided senior leadership, capital, and credibility from Philadelphia. He maintained oversight, but allowed JP significant autonomy, recognizing his ambitious nature. The firm would start with a capital base of several million dollars. Exact figures are unclear, but equivalent to somewhere around 50 to 100 million in 2025 dollars, bolstered by Drexel's wealth and JP's access to London funds. Their network included European banks, U.S. railroads, and industrialists, giving them a competitive edge. The partnership's reliance on elite connections, including Junius Morgan's London ties, drew early criticism for favoritism. The New York Herald suggested the firm was a closed club for the wealthy, echoing perceptions of John D. Rockefeller's 1870s railroad rebates with insiders like Cornelius Vanderbilt. Drexel, Morgan & Company issued bonds and stocks for railroads, governments, and corporations, which earned them commissions. It acted as a middleman between investors and issuers, a role JP perfected. The firm also specialized in funding railroads, which required massive capital for tracks, locomotives, and expansion. JP underwrote bonds for lines like the New York Central and Philadelphia and Reading. Leveraging Drexel's European ties and J.S. Morgan & Company's London base, the firm also facilitated transatlantic investments, trading currencies and securities. Lastly, JP began advising distressed railroads, refinancing debt and installing managers, a process later called Morganization.
To try to put into perspective, you know, what we're really talking about here, consider today if there was someone who was 34 years old and someone giving them control of $100 million in 2025. In 2025, that's considered a lot of money, and that would be a very rare thing for someone that young to have control. This is 1871. The man is 34, and they're shuffling around hundreds of millions, but it's the same old story. What do they have? They have connections everywhere, but transportation is one of the big ones, but they have ins to the banking in London. Not only are they untouchable, they're throwing around amounts of money that are literally obscene, and they're taking it all over, literally taking it all over.
As we have been discussing, railroads were the era's largest industry, with 33,000 miles of track being laid between 1868 and 1873, which was fueled by $2 billion in bonds and stocks, which would be over $50 billion in modern-day dollars. Many banks were heavily invested in railroad securities, which tied their solvency to the industry. The lack of a central bank at this time, after the Second Bank of the United States dissolved in 1836, left no mechanism to stabilize liquidity, or so the claim goes, which was supposedly a vulnerability that had been exposed in the Panic of 1857. Germany was shifting to the gold standard in 1871, which reduced silver demand, tightening European credit and curbing foreign investment in U.S. railroads. This then strained domestic markets that were already overheated by post-Civil War growth. Government land grants and subsidies, like for Union Pacific, fueled a speculative frenzy, with railroad stocks inflating beyond their earning potential, which could be compared in similarity to the dot-com bubble of the 2000s. The Panic of 1873 tested JP's acumen, offering him a chance to expand his influence while competitors were faltering, much like Cornelius Vanderbilt and John D. Rockefeller had leveraged the crisis in their industries. By 1873, railroads had accumulated $1 billion in debt, or over $25 billion in 2025 dollars, with many unable to cover their interest payments. Speculative bonds fueled unprofitable lines, which then created a bubble. Banks were holding railroad bonds as collateral, which was going to prove a problem for many of them. On September 18, 1873, Jay Cooke and Company declared bankruptcy after they failed to sell Northern Pacific bonds, which sparked panic. Cooke's collapse, given its prominence in Civil War bond sales, eroded investor confidence. And so, the New York Stock Exchange suspended trading for 10 days, from September 20th to the 30th, 1873, which was a rare event as railroad stocks dropped 30 to 50%. Over 100 banks had failed by October, and 5,000 businesses collapsed in 1873 alone. The crisis led to a prolonged depression. Unlike Jay Cooke and Company, which had failed due to overexposure to Northern Pacific bonds, Drexel, Morgan and Company weathered the crisis. JP's conservative strategy, which emphasized due diligence and diversified investments, kept their firm solvent. His partnership with Anthony Drexel provided access to Philadelphia capital, while his father's J.S. Morgan and Company in London ensured transatlantic liquidity. JP also maintained cash holdings that are estimated at $5 to $10 million at the time, or roughly to $100 to $200 million today, which was a significant buffer compared to competitors who relied on credit. This mirrored Vanderbilt's New York Central reserves during the 1857 panic. JP had also avoided speculative railroad bonds, focusing on established lines with recoverable assets instead. His firm continued underwriting select securities, which enabled them to maintain client trust. The panic crashed railroad bond prices, with securities trading at 20 to 30 cents on the dollar. JP leveraged his cash reserves to purchase bonds of bankrupt or struggling lines, targeting those with strong infrastructure, but had temporary financial woes. And so, he was able to scoop up bonds on Philadelphia and Reading Railroad, Illinois Central Railroad, and Erie Railroad. These purchases yield significant returns as bond values rebounded by 1875 and 1876, netting JP an estimated 5 to 10 million in profits, or 100 to 200 in today's dollars. They also positioned him as a railroad power broker, leading to the 1879 New York Central deal with William Henry Vanderbilt.
I mean, come on. You're going to call him a power broker? Why don't you call him a monopolist? By the way, why don't you ask if they intentionally caused this issue? But if you go way back up to the top where they're talking about Germany, Germany shifts to a solid monetary system, gold-backed, the way everyone should be all the time if you're going to have a monetary system. And what happens? It threatens what they're doing because they're doing it with bonds and paper and manipulation and mechanism and devices. So it's interesting to see that when Germany goes to a solid money system, it creates problems. And so what happens? They shut down the stock exchange. 100 banks fail. 5,000 businesses. This is going on in 1873. Nothing ever changes. And since we still look forward through history, seeing similar things as this happening again and again and again, shouldn't we be asking, is this being done on purpose? Well, I mean, what do you think, Jason? Isn't that really the question?
Well, this reminds me of the mortgage thing that was going on maybe, what was that, about 15 years ago or so, where they kept flipping the mortgages and reselling them and reselling them and reselling them. It's just paper backing up paper and really doesn't mean anything. No wonder why these things crash. But these people are able to ride these waves and cash in massively before the things blow up.
I'm glad you used the 08 housing crash, because here they're calling him a power broker and they're not apparently asking who caused this. And they're allowing him to basically eat up whole sectors like railroad. In 08, what happened? All my life, if you wanted a home loan, you had to belly up to the bar and prove things. You had to prove income that you could cover that loan. And it was not the easiest thing to pull off. And all of a sudden, magically, one day, you can get as many home loans as you want. We'll just write them to you. They're later found out to be predatory. So what I'm getting at is they did it on purpose, and they did it without even trying to cover up. And if we look back, this is probably the seeds to that mindset. Back then, they're hiding it, or however they're doing it, but it's been going on so long in 08. They just simply do it and look at the damage they caused and what was done about it. Nothing was done about it.
Even if it was an organic crash going on, they don't give a damn because they're just going to do what they've proven over and over again, where they're going to consolidate wealth underneath their titles.
I've got a very strong point of view on what happened in 08. I knew people who were flipping houses. Some of those people had 5 houses because it was so easy to get the loan. What was going on is they decided that they were going to start their run for the future where people don't own homes and everybody's a renter. That is my view on what happened in 08. Not only was it done openly, the way that I look at it, it's starting to culminate now where we get the reports that, you know, somewhere like BlackRock bought, wait for it, 33% of all the homes in a given year that went on the market. The first time I ever saw the apartments.com ad with Jeff Goldblum, a cold wave went down my spine. I recognized what that was about and where this is going. This is going to a generation, if they get their way, where you do not own homes. You rent. That's that. And in my view, what happened in 08 is just an extension of what we're talking about back here when it was hidden. And no one's even accused, by the way, to we do this in the open and there's nothing you can do about it.
In 1879, by the whopping age of 42, JP, along with his firm, had become a powerhouse in investment banking with a specialization in underwriting railroad securities and restructuring distressed lines, and had also proven its railroad expertise during the 1873 panic with their restructuring of lines like the Philadelphia and Reading. William Henry Vanderbilt, the son of Cornelius, was aware of JP's success and transatlantic connections via J.S. Morgan & Company in London. Wanting to reduce his exposure to railroad volatility, especially after the 1873 panic and 1877 strike, William Henry chose JP to handle the converting of stock into cash or bonds. Because of the volatility at the time, a large sale like this required careful execution to avoid crashing the New York Central's value, a challenge that JP was equipped to meet. And so, in late 1879, JP arranged the sale of 250,000 shares of New York Central stock, which was valued at $25 million, or approximately $600 million in 2025 dollars, representing approximately 20% of William Henry Vanderbilt's holdings. The stock was sold at $120 per share, which was a premium that reflected the railroad's strong earnings, which was a 7% dividend yield. To prevent a market crash, JP formed a syndicate of investors, including U.S. investors such as New York banks and wealthy clients of Drexel Morgan like the Astor family, and European investors such as London and Paris banks, facilitated by J.S. Morgan and Company, who were eager to invest in stable American railroads. The syndicate agreed to purchase the shares gradually, which stabilized the stock price, ensuring demand. Drexel, Morgan & Company underwrote the sale, guaranteeing the stock's placement and earning a commission that is estimated at 2-3%, or $500,000 to $750,000, or $12 to $18 million in today's money. JP's firm also managed the logistics, coordinating with the New York Stock Exchange and European markets. The wealthy know how to protect the wealthy.
And I would add what's probably more is, can you imagine how all the bankers and the rich people in the world were looking at the size of the numbers representing dollars this man was making, controlling, and manipulating? I mean, think about it. Could there be anywhere in the world where people are bankers or interested in money where they weren't abrogating the idea from the Bible of that's a land of milk and honey? You know, it's true. Because at the end of the day, not too long or even around this area, the royals and the aristocracy in Europe can't even pay their bills anymore because the feudal times are behind them. And they start seeking marriages into this just money machine. And by the way, that's what the new HBO, I don't know if it's coming back. Supposedly it's coming back. The Gilded Age HBO show is specifically about what we're talking about here, with railroads dead center.
The new money, as they called it.
Exactly. There's no family ties. There's no Latin names that ties it to ancient Rome like Junius or Cornelius. It's just simply Americans that presumably have an education, well, the younger generation does, but mom and dad, they are filthy rich to a level that modern history can't compare.
In 1882, JP restructures major railroads, including the Philadelphia and Reading and Chesapeake and Ohio, by refinancing debt and installing managers who were loyal to him. His Morganization process, as it gets called, creates efficient, profitable lines but reduces competition. JP's consolidations create near monopolies, raising freight rates and burdening farmers in a similar manner to Vanderbilt's New York Central pricing. The New York World labels him a railroad czar and accuses him of stifling innovation. Continuing on with his railroad expertise, in 1885, JP mediates a truce between the New York Central and the rival West Shore Railroad, merging them to end a rate war. The deal stabilizes the industry, but of course, eliminates competition. JP's role as a peacemaker is said to mask his profit motive, as it earned him millions in fees while consolidating control. Critics argue he prioritizes Wall Street over public interest. They are not wrong.
Nah, he's treating everyone else as their dogs. At this point, he's probably starting to treat other rich people like this because he's got so much power. But at the top of this, you're listing more railroads that he's basically consolidating and controlling. I mean, how many railroads are left, I would ask? We haven't named a lot of the Western world yet. I'm not sure, I would have to look, but I mean, he's got to be getting close to beyond the lion's share. But I would ask the question, since he's going around to stressed railroads and he has so much power with all these other rail lines, is he causing the stress? Is this a part of history that we're never going to read about? Is it possible that he was making it hard for railroads in one way or another at the bank or the money market, or Lord only knows, because this is an awful lot of rail lines that are, quote, distressed that he's going to target?
As I said on the live stream, I don't know if people realize just how important railroads were at this time. The amount of things that they were used for. People used them for transportation, but the amount of goods that were sent around was absolutely incredible.
You couldn't overstate what you just said. It is a massive deal. That's why even in things like 9/11, who's involved? Transportation, air transportation in our era. If you go back to the rail, I mean, to move freight in a land that's now basically a cash machine compared to Europe anyhow, these are a major, major deal. And he's basically got his arms around them. And if you look at any, if you actually take a solid look at any major transportation, they've always been controlled. Go look at that movie with DiCaprio, where he's portraying Howard Hughes. And listen to some of the talk, the boardroom talks they put forward about how air transportation is being handled and controlled and tied into the Senate to ensure they get what they want. Yeah, it's a big, big deal. Oh, by the way, railroads are such a big deal. It's how we tell time. The timetables get put in place eventually because of the railroad, so they can schedule and they artificially put in the time zones. And most people don't think it's a big deal, but it kind of is. If you're a person who recognizes the only thing that truly exists is this second, then what I just said is a big deal. If you want to think about yesterday, you're thinking about a thing that doesn't exist. If you want to think about tomorrow, the same is true. For spiritual seekers, they very early on recognize that everything exists in this second. And this is where I have to focus my consciousness. When you come in with time zones and things like that, you've changed the way we think to pull us into that fantasy land. Now there's an 800-mile wide time zone where a man on the western border and a man on the eastern border, 800 miles apart, are both going to say, oh, it's 6 a.m. That doesn't work. If they both stood there at sunrise, there would be a significant difference in the time. Do you see how the fantasy-based reality begins to creep into our lives so that commerce can occur?
By the late 1880s, the new technology of the electrical industry was emerging as a transformative sector spurred by Thomas Edison's invention of the incandescent light bulb in 1879, as well as advancements in electrical power systems. Two companies dominated at the time, the first of which was Edison General Electric Company, which had been formed in 1887 and focused on direct current, or DC, systems for lighting and power, which was backed by Edison's patents and New York investors. The second was the Thomson-Houston Electric Company, which was based in Lynn, Massachusetts, and specialized in alternating current, or AC, systems, which was led by Elihu Thompson and Charles A. Coffin, who had stronger manufacturing capabilities. This difference in technologies was creating the War of the Currents, a rivalry between DC and AC, which was creating market inefficiencies, along with competing standards and patent disputes. JP, who was now quite adept at resolving industrial conflicts and in typical robber baron fashion, saw an opportunity to merge the leading firms, eliminate competition, and dominate the electrical market. With this in mind, JP finances the merger of Edison Electric and Thomson Houston to form General Electric in 1892, which becomes a dominant electrical firm. His investment secures control over this burgeoning industry. JP's influence over General Electric's board limits smaller competitors, mirroring tactics used by Standard Oil. The Chicago Tribune accuses JP of electrifying monopolies.
I mean, he even names the new endeavor after the highest military rank, general, to make the pun. But how big a deal is this? Can you try to imagine? And by the way, I was told that in that HBO show, The Golden Age, they portray, I think it was in the last season, the first lighting up of things in New York. Can you imagine the change that hits when electricity and artificial lighting come to be? I mean, that's got to be bigger than when the internet arrived. But to put a frame of reference, they've got electricity now. They're cornering the market. Some of the richest folks in the world are doing it. And everything in our world to this day is electric or electromagnetic. And anything that matters to include the natural systems are directly tied to electricity. And people are quite aware of the work I'm doing on the sun. And I do not accept for a second we are looking at a nuclear furnace. Neither do people like Eric Dollard or others that I respect who are much brighter than I will ever be. That's electricity. That is electric up there that we are looking at. So this little section where electricity is coming online and these fat cats are already putting a noose around it, it's a big, big deal. It's such a big deal that we're still living under this reality now. We all have the meters on our house, and a growing number of us recognize that it would not be that hard to harvest electricity for free.
In 1893, yet another severe financial crisis, considered one of the worst in United States history, causes another depression that will last until 1897. Again, railroads had much to do with it, as by 1893, the U.S. had 176,000 miles of railroad track, with $5 billion in capital invested, or over $150 billion in modern money. Many lines, like the Northern Pacific and Erie, were overbuilt in unprofitable regions and were financed by speculative bonds and stocks, a situation that echoed the Panic of 1873. Banks were holding railroad securities as collateral, which made them vulnerable to defaults. The Sherman Silver Purchase Act of 1890, which required the Treasury to buy silver with notes redeemable in gold, drained gold reserves and sparked a currency crisis. Once again, the lack of a central bank exacerbated liquidity shortages, as seen in 1857 and 1873, all of which would be used as the excuse for the creation of the Federal Reserve early in the next century. Over 15,000 businesses failed by 1894, with railroad stocks dropping 40 to 60%, unemployment hitting 18% in urban areas, and industrial output falling 25%. Also by 1894, 192 railroads, which controlled 40,000 miles or 25% of U.S. track, were bankrupt, which included Erie, Northern Pacific, and Union Pacific. JP, of course, was just fine, with Drexel Morgan & Company remaining solvent, unlike banks that were exposed to railroad defaults. JP set about organizing investor syndicates to rescue failing firms, pooling funds from Boston, New York, and European banks. These syndicates injected capital into distressed railroads and banks, which prevented systemic collapse. Syndicates are said to have saved key firms, preserving jobs and freight networks, but also gave JP influence over their boards, expanding his control again, like the 1873 restructurings. JP's partner, Anthony J. Drexel, passes away on June 30th, 1893, and marks a significant shift in the firm's structure and leadership, solidifying JP's personal control over the investment banking powerhouse, which officially becomes JP Morgan & Company in 1895.
I mean, you're never going to convince me with what we read about, what's been reported, that they weren't causing the problems damn near every time. It's almost like there's a secret schedule, like the train schedule, where there's going to be a panic or a collapse or a depression of some sort at some level every 10 to 30 years or so. But the big news here is where he talks about from 1857 to 73, which is going to be used as the excuse to create the Federal Reserve. Are you ready to become chattel? Are you ready to be a capital good in a capitalism system? Because, as we have covered in the Law series, human beings are going to be monetized. And this is where it starts.
By 1895, the United States was still grappling with the aftermath of the Panic of 1893, with the crisis exacerbating underlying economic issues, particularly the U.S. Treasury's dwindling gold reserves, which threatened the nation's commitment to the gold standard, where currency was redeemable in gold. The U.S. gold-based currency required the Treasury to hold at least $100 million in gold reserves to back paper notes and silver certificates. By early 1895, the reserves had fallen to $41 million, or over $1.2 billion in 2025 dollars, the lowest since the Civil War. By 1895, J.P. Morgan, at the helm of Drexel Morgan & Company, was America's preeminent banker, and he came to the rescue. He was aware of the crisis through his New York and London contacts and saw an opportunity to stabilize the economy and enhance his influence. His firm's European ties, via J.S. Morgan & Company, gave him access to gold that was held by British and French banks, which was critical for a bailout. JP was aiming to protect his railroad and industrial investments, which depended on a stable currency. A successful bailout promised a hefty commission as well as political leverage. President Grover Cleveland, who was wary of Wall Street, initially resisted JP's involvement, preferring government-led solutions. However, with reserves nearing zero, it is said that he had no alternative. JP met with President Cleveland and Treasury Secretary John G. Carlisle in Washington, D.C. on February 7, 1895, proposing a private syndicate to sell U.S. bonds and replenish the gold reserves. He leveraged an obscure 1862 law that allowed private bond sales to bypass congressional approval. The deal was that J.P. Syndicate, led by Drexel Morgan & Company and August Belmont & Company, who was a New York ally, would sell $65 million in 30-year U.S. Treasury bonds, or over $2 billion in 2025 dollars, at 4% interest and payable in gold. The syndicate guaranteed delivery of 3.5 million ounces of gold worth $65 million to the Treasury, half-sourced from European banks. The syndicate sold bonds to investors at 104.5% of par value, which was $68.25 million, earning a profit by reselling at 112%, $72.8 million, netting $4.5 million, or over $135 million in today's money. JP's commission was $5 million, or over $150 million in today's money, including fees and profits. On February 8, 1895, President Cleveland approves the deal, with JP signing the contract. Between February 20th and March 1895, the gold shipments arrive, boosting reserves to $107 million by March. Bonds were sold in New York and London, which stabilized the markets. By June of 1895, the Treasury's reserves are holding, averting default, though renewed withdrawals required a second bond issue in 1896 for $100 million and again led by JP. The bailout did restore confidence, halting gold runs and stabilizing the dollar. Stock markets rallied 10% by April, and various railroad bonds recovered 20%. The gold standard was preserved, supporting trade and, of course, JP's investments. JP was hailed as a savior by Wall Street, with the Wall Street Journal in 1895 calling him America's banker. Leveraging his political influence the following year, JP would back presidential candidate William McKinley, who was a pro-gold, pro-business Ohio governor who was behind tariffs and currency stability. McKinley won the election.
Well, go figure. How can that be? Well, he's already monopolized so many other things. I guess getting the press, the Wall Street Journal, in your pocket was child's play. But let's ask a couple simple questions. How is it that these banks are smart enough to take over damn near everything and control damn near everything, but they're not smart enough to avoid all these big issues like, oh, we're going to run out of gold and these other things? I'm not buying. These things are completely constructed, planned, and executed from my personal point of view. And isn't it just kind of a amazing thing that when they go to do their bailout, they leverage an obscure 1862 law? Is that pre-planning? Is that what we're looking at here? I'm just saying, they show all this innovation and this business at levels we've never seen. But for some reason, the banks can never quite figure out how to be stable.
Moving into the 20th century and the year 1901, J.P. Morgan, who is now aged 64, was the preeminent banker in the United States, leading J.P. Morgan & Company. His firm dominated investment banking, underwriting securities, restructuring railroads, and financing industrial ventures. The Gilded Age is now thought of as having ended by 1901, but it had been a period of rapid industrialization with railroads, steel, and oil driving economic growth. The steel industry, which was critical for railroads, skyscrapers, and manufacturing, had been led by Andrew Carnegie's Carnegie Steel Company, which controlled 25% of U.S. steel production by 1900, leveraging the Bessemer process and vertical integration. Other players had included Morgan's Federal Steel Company, which had been formed in 1898, and smaller firms like National Steel and American Steel and Wire. John D. Rockefeller owned vast iron ore deposits in Minnesota's Mesabi Range, which supplied steelmakers like Carnegie. The steel industry faced intense competition and price volatility, with Carnegie threatening to expand into finished products like rails and wire, which would challenge JP's firms. JP was inspired by his railroad and electrical consolidations and sought to merge leading steel companies to eliminate competition, stabilize prices, and create a monopoly that was akin to Rockefeller's Standard Oil or Vanderbilt's New York Central. The Panic of 1893 had shown the risks of overcompetition, and JP's 1895 bailout had elevated his influence, positioning him to orchestrate a transformative deal in 1901. After negotiations, in January of 1901, Andrew Carnegie agreed to sell Carnegie Steel for $480 million, or over $15 billion in modern money, which included $225 million in cash and $255 million in bonds. JP also negotiated with John D. Rockefeller, who demanded $88 million, or over $2.5 billion in modern money, for his Mesabi Range mines, which included $8 million in cash and $80 million in stock. Rockefeller's son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., and advisor Frederick T. Gates ensured a premium valuation. After all was said and done, on March 2nd, 1901, JP announced the creation of United States Steel Corporation, capitalized at $1.4 billion, or over $45 billion in 2025 money, the world's first billion-dollar company.
The world's first billion-dollar company, steel. Big deal in this country. Well, it used to be. We even had an NFL team. Do you remember them? The Pittsburgh Steelers? We used to make stuff in this country. You could almost begin to follow the two robber baron timelines that we've laid down and some of the main players and start to deduce that these men, if you want to call them that, corporations sucked this country dry. And then when business was focused somewhere else so they could continue to grow, they threw it under the bus. We don't make things here anymore. We're not known for American steel. And it was better. When I got out of the Marine Corps in the 90s, I bought a telescope made by Meade in the United States with American steel. That thing is as solid today as it was then. That is not true of the telescopes that we buy now. We've downgraded the quality of what we make down to even the steel is not as good. People offer to buy those classic scopes because they know that those gears and that American steel and what's running it is tough and it will last. I mean, wouldn't you look at it that way, Jason? It's basically like they're taking it all over, getting as much control as they can, and they're sucking it dry. And when they've had their way, they shift all the manufacturing to somewhere else where they continue sucking on that straw, removing the lifeblood of wherever they go.
Well, the big difference was back then, the United States made so much of its own stuff, and generally speaking, it was very good quality. Once you get to the overseas situation, everything is being done to maximize profits by paying the workers as little as possible and using the cheapest parts possible you could possibly use to get the job done, or at least have it last long enough before it breaks.
And that is a key point. When we live in a world where the Bilderbergs have openly said depopulation is one of their bullet points for this year's meeting, and what else? Climate change. Climate change is a big deal. And yet, places like this, corporations like this, have for decades now planned obsolescence. When I was a kid and you bought a TV, that thing went your whole damn life. Now you buy a TV, you're lucky if you get a year or two. And even if it's still running, it's obsolete because the tech has changed. The OS has changed. Something has changed. Look at computers. How often do computers even get upgraded to the point? This is a complete sham, all of it. How can you sit there and scream about the environment of this world while corporations openly sell crap that's going to end up in the garbage can, like damn near 90% of it, probably. In the part of the country where I live in New England, you take a drive through some of the older neighborhoods and they have trouble getting the houses painted. Why? Because the painter says, oh, that's too intricate. You know, we'd have to charge too much. What are they talking about? These houses are gorgeous. The trim, the uniqueness, and just the quality that was built into it doesn't allow them to come in and slap, you know, a single coat of paint on all these square and rectangular shapes, because there's actually pride of craftsmanship and detail and quality built into it. How is it that we've fallen so far? It's not hard to answer that question. Because of capitalism and what these men have done with that system. They've gamed it. They've broken the rules. They've lived below the law, as I like to say, and they've brought us to where we are. And the very arguments that they're using at the Bilderberg are ludicrous. The average human being has no input on the vehicle they drive. That's the corporations deciding what that's going to be. This idea that when you go into a Walmart, 95% of the crap on those shelves built in another country is going to be in a landfill in the next year or two or five. Do you see the game that's going on here?
All right, so that's going to do it for hour one. When we come back in hour two, we're going to finish up with JP Morgan, and then we're going to get into another interesting figure, Andrew Carnegie and his steel empire.
So weird to consider what a big deal steel was and the Pittsburgh Steelers that represented that when I was young. And that's all a million miles in the rear view. And I mean, if I asked you, Joe, when you were young, do you feel like things were better quality by far than they are now?
Oh, goodness, yes.
Because when I was young, I mean, even a pair of scissors, like when I bought this house, the things that were left behind from like the 40s and 50s, like a pair of scissors, I mean, they're just superior. Some of the silverware, the dish, just almost everything. And the old grandfather's tools that were left here, they're superior. They are quality made. They are tough. They are just better on every level. And that has just been degraded to the point where what we do now is we make things that are going to get thrown away because they've been designed in that way. When I got out of the Marine Corps in the 90s, I had purchased a TV in Japan that shipped home with me. When I got here, I used it for about a week and it quit working. I knew a guy who was an electronics genius. He said, for 10 bucks, I'll come take a look at it and fix it. I said, wow, you can fix a TV? He said, no problem. He was a bit of an electrical savant. Opens up the television, says, yep, I knew it. And he holds up, I want to say it was a capacitor, but I'm not an electricity guy. It was a little black cylinder that was tiny. He said, this is a 10-cent part, and it is designed to fail in about a year. That was the early 90s. How this is allowed to go on, I mean, it beggars the imagination. But anyhow, that's hour one. Do you want to add anything more, Jason?
Well, just going through these people, we're now going to be moving into the fourth one in our series here. They used a lot of the same tactics. And it just shows you, if they could get away with that stuff then, what is going on with modern corporations? Are they able to do similar things with their restructuring and their gobbling up of other smaller companies and making these giant mega corporations? I would like to suggest that yes, I think so.
I would suggest that back then, there were a lot fewer people corrupted. The one thing about human beings, particularly in this country, is we love money. And there was a lot of people corrupted with that money. But what's been in the news recently, you know, it's been hard times. Probably a lot easier to corrupt a lot of people when times are hard. But we're also aware how the camera has been used to control and corrupt people. But that's been hour one of episode 632, part two of The Robber Barons. Hour one is free at crow777radio.com. That is crrow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode and they get access to all the comments and forum sections. They can create top level topics. They can stream the 2-hour film called Shoot the Moon that covers an immense slot of my telescopic work to include lunar waves, all the UFO things, the shooting orb, invisible vortexes, the first filming of the so-called second sun, and all the still work I'm doing with my current telescope is available on the website, as is exclusive to members, all of the video and other work I am doing with my solar telescope, exclusively waiting for my shot at that other body to try to prove what it is. With that, we're going to wrap up, take a short break. We'll be back for hour two, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers. I hope to see you logged in as a member. We'll be right back.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.